Hello, and welcome to the Library Cafe on WVKR, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Today's guest is Jeffrey Bowker, Regis and Diane McKenna Professor at Santa Clara University and Executive Director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Society at Santa Clara. Jeffrey is talking with us by telephone about his latest book entitled Memory Practices in the Sciences, published by MIT. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thank you very much.
I want to start off by saying that I enjoyed reading your book immensely. Librarians like myself who have to think about what part of the seemingly infinite numbers of records that our society produces should be preserved for the future are keenly aware of how difficult a task this is, both as a matter of theory but also as a matter of daily practice. And more importantly, the difficulties that we now face with the production of vast quantities of digital data are forcing us, as well as the people who produce and use this data, to reconsider what we're doing. And the kinds of questions we have to ask ourselves: what is scientific knowledge and where is it? How is it shaped? How has it changed? What is scientific and historical memory and what makes something memorable are exactly what your book is concerned with. So I wonder if you could start by talking about the term you use in your title, memory practice, and why thinking about memory practices is important.
Sure. The reason that I particularly use the term memory practice is to get away from the idea that memory is something which is just held in the head by the individual, you know, kind of stored to meet in that terrible term that some computer scientists use, instead of storing to disk. And I think what I wanted to do was explode that idea and say, well, let's consider all the ways in which memory works in our society, in our daily lives. Very simple things. I store some things to my own mind, to my own memory, but I also, before I go out in the morning, I will leave things by the door as a reminder to myself as I'm going out to pick them up. As I move through an old town, I'll see the church in the center of the town or village and the market square, and that'll provide a kind of memory for me, again, another kind of memory of the history of the place that I came from. So there are many, many ways in which we indulge in memory practice in our lives, that It's both a material process in terms of what we store and remember and an immaterial process in terms of what's in the head. A real simple way of thinking about this is in terms of, as Jacques Derrida talked about with email, that really you can say that the nature of human consciousness has changed over the last 20 years in the sense that in the old days when I made fleeting remarks or, you know, kind of dropped someone a quick line or said something over the telephone, that disappeared into the ether and was gone forever. Now that kind of immediate knee-jerk reaction, which we called in the old days flaming, to lots of email messages, now that's available to me and I still have it. I can show you a flame that I wrote or a flame that I received in 1996, you know, when I started keeping my full email records. So the practices themselves change, the memory practices, the constitution of our memory and our access to ourselves and our access to our own society changes as we develop new information infrastructures, as we develop new technologies. So the whole idea of memory practices was to say, well, what are the range of practices that are involved in really trying to produce this dream of the universal archive?
Yeah. I was at a musical in New York recently where there were a lot of tourists and people were taking flash photographs in the house happily before the curtain went up, not after, but there were so many people really frenetically and frantically doing this that I really had to wonder about it, since at that point there wasn't anything to see. And obviously it's the act of taking the photograph here that's important, you know, not the viewing of it later so much. In fact, it's unlikely many of these photos will be looked at ever again or more than once, yet obviously the taking of the snapshot here is a kind of memory act, isn't it? And it's facilitated, of course, by the technology and the fact that people have cell phones now that can take photos.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the title of Derrida's book is Archive Fever, and, you know, it's about we are obsessively trying to record everything, obsessively trying to remember everything, where we don't really have a concept of who the, you know, who the eventual reader or viewer will be. Serge Tisserand talking about that very act of taking photographs, and this is before the age of the digital photograph, when it's got a lot worse, says that basically, you know, over 60% of films are never developed. When they are developed, you might look at them once and then throw them away. The number that actually get reused is vanishingly small. Therefore, the importance of the photograph is not the fact that it serves as a memory device necessarily, it's the act of framing the present and creating this kind of ongoing history. The blogosphere is much the same as far as I'm concerned. I mean, someone was describing to me a conference they went to the other day where there were 30 people in the room, 15 people were typing blogs as the conference went on, which made an awful racket. But it's also, who do they imagine the reader is going to be? The average readership of a scientific article is, I think, between 3 and 5 people outside of the review process.
Yeah.
So we have this idea that somewhere, in, you know, in some other world, everyone's got time and leisure to really rework these archives. But really, that's not what they're about. That's not what the practices are about.
In some ways, we tend to think of recording and remembering as the same kind of act, but also then they aren't really.
Well, I think that's right. The term that I use for that is one of potential memory. If you look at the recording practices that are going on right now today in our society, they've often, for legal reasons, we are storing information for such and such a purpose, or for technical reasons, you know, that you want to know. We record vast amounts of information about the telephone network, for example, on a daily basis in monitoring it. We store that information. That's only very, very rarely useful, but it's potentially useful in the grounds that, hey, a tree goes down somewhere in Kansas which sets off a blackout several states, then you want to be able to track it backwards.
You make a point, and this is in the context of what you said earlier about thinking about memory as something in your head, that memory practices actually allow us to forget, and this is bound up with one of the functions of classification.
Yeah, that's right. It's a sort of complex point there, but I think that, you know, anyone who's worked as an archivist or worked as a librarian will certainly appreciate that the form that the archive takes is governed equally by what is excluded from the archive as what is included in it. So in the act of classification, speaking very, very broadly about classification, in the act of classification you're saying, here's what I can afford to forget about what's gone on. And this can have some really interesting implications. Let me give you my favorite example of this. This is on the history of AIDS. Now, we all know that AIDS was invented, in the mid to late 1980s. And ever since then, we've had very good systems for tracking AIDS. Now, there's pretty good empirical evidence that AIDS was around in the 1950s, and there's, you know, there are historical arguments, maybe Erasmus had AIDS. But the 1950s case is interesting. It was a Norwegian sailor who was in Kenya, returned back to Norway, seems to have infected his whole family, and they all died, and that was the end of the story, so it didn't spread into the pandemic. Now, the point is that under the system of medical classifications that were working at that stage, there was no way in the world that you can actually trace back previous cases, previous possible cases of AIDS, uh-huh. because they would get scattered too far. There might be some under Kaposi's sarcoma, some under pneumonia, some others under other kind of happenstance infections that people get with a depressed immune system. So the classification of the people into these different categories has actually ended up hiding from us a possible connection or a possible pathway which we now recognize would cluster those diseases or would cluster those deaths into single diseases. So it's not only enabling forgetting, it's in a sense it's enforcing forgetting in some bad ways as well as enabling it in some good ways. The way in which it enables in good ways is slightly different. Nobody can remember everything. You might have dream of total recall, and just because memory is cheap and you've got terabytes of memory, you know, might be absolutely marvelous, but the human brain and human practices are not able to deal with terabytes of memory. Yeah. We need to be able to sort out the winnow from the chaff, and we need to be able to say, okay, there's some stuff that I really, really don't need to know in order to continue with my practice, in order to be a good scientist, in order to be a good social scientist or humanities scholar, or in my daily life. There's some stuff I can just safely forget. And I think that's a really good role for classification systems, because as you put things into classes of various kinds, then you're saying, okay, this event is equivalent to that event, is equivalent to the other event. We don't need to know their specific differences. They're close enough for our purposes that we can call it all the same thing. The same way that, you know, if we want to call something a chair, we don't necessarily need to have to remember whether it's got 4 legs or whether it's on rollers or whether it takes a particular shape or other. We just need to know it's a chair for most purposes. Mm-hmm. So the classifying it as a chair is enabling us to forget all those extraneous features we don't want to remember. Now, the key point there, and I realize I'm going on a little bit at length here, but the key point here is that you don't want to get into the Aristotelian theory of classification, which is to say that there are the inherent qualities of, say, a chair, say, a bug, say, a tree, and then there's the extraneous qualities, and that we can build up single great universal classification systems which only deal with inherent qualities. I think what I've shown and what the history of science, well, not me, but what the history of science has shown over the last several hundred years is that everything we think is a single basic inherent quality can be argued and does change historically. So that classification systems are intimately rooted in our understandings of ourselves, our understandings of others, in our political systems, and in our value systems.
So your book is about the way that science, since the beginning of the 19th century, has imagined its own archive and memory practices. And you've actually classified this history for the modern epoch into three eras. So let's talk first about Gilbert Lyell and the Great Age of Geology, which, as you tell a story, was enabled by, and in some respects an expression of, industrialization and innovations in the keeping of business records in the 19th century.
We're essentially going to run through three sciences, you know, as we work through the book: geology, cybernetics and biodiversity, science today. And the reason I chose each of those for their epochs is that they were the really, really hot sciences of their times. Geologists in the 1830s, the time that I'm mostly writing about, which is the apogee of the Industrial Revolution in England, geologists in the 1830s in France, in England, throughout Europe, were sort of superstars. Geologists in the 1830s would appear before society doing demonstrations. They would have hundreds and hundreds of people attending their lectures. They would take out field trips wherever they went. People read geology, cared about it. It really hit a key point of national consciousness in a number of different countries. Now, what happens in the 1830s is that it's sort of strange, because we go from a period where you really think that the history of the Earth has changed significantly over time. So it was very young in the early days and violent. Then it had its kind of tempestuous youth and then settled down in the Middle Age, and now we were kind of in the Middle Age bit. So the idea that we went from many, many catastrophes in the past, so a past marked by catastrophes and very uneven in its development, to the present, which is basically a very quiet time.
Yeah, the Earth had a kind of human biography.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Now, Lyell really took the stuffing out of that in very interesting ways. What Lyell did was to say, well, no, time is much, much bigger than you think. We don't need a tempestuous youth. We just need a very, very, very slow and continuous and permanent middle age, if you like. That everything that seems to you, to me, on the surface of it, and literally on the surface of the Earth, to indicate huge past shifts, like the throwing up of mountains, like the fact that we can find sand and fossils from sea creatures at 20,000 feet. We don't need to explain that in terms of very, very fast processes. We can explain it in terms of very, very slow processes. Now, the key thing that Lyell does that really ties this vision into industrialization and the industrial era, the key point that he makes is that it's basically a double-entry bookkeeping system. That the way in which the Earth works is it's always got the same amount of dry land, it's always got the same amount of ocean. For every process of erosion, there is a process of accretion. So it's a perpetual zero-sum game. So what you're doing is you've got your debit column, you've got your credit column, and if you're a good geologist, by the end of the day, they all add up to zero. So what we have is essentially an eternal Earth with basically zero change. Now, I mean, that's a technique, if you like, which was borrowed from bookkeeping, which is borrowed from business practice, and moves across into geology. And that's one of the points that I really, really try to make. I think it's really important about information infrastructures in general, is that techniques travel via information infrastructures. So it's not surprising to find something in organization theory or something in business practice appearing in the science of geology or the science of biodiversity, because the information infrastructure provides the channel which allows that to happen.
Interesting. And you make a similar point about the development of timekeeping and the, you know, profusion of clocks in the early 19th century and the way they seem to take over. And then that's extended into space with the ability to keep time so that the railroads can be built.
I think that's right. It's really interesting the ways in which it penetrates. There was a wonderful article in Minerva a few years back, which was about the desire to create what they call, quote-unquote, a clockwork ocean, so that we would understand the ocean in the same way as we understood the workings of a clock. And that was, again, from the middle of the 19th century. What was meant by that was, well, going backwards to the 1760s, we've got the determination of longitude, we've got the fact that we need to kind of deal with large empires, and as we deal with large empires, how do we do that? Well, you know, we need to organize ship travel, we need to organize the world, we need to understand it in terms of its quadrants, in terms of its space. So it's a way of understanding the world which fits, you know, the nascent imperialism of those days, which fits the creation of empire. And that timekeeping really became central symbolically for that period. Mm-hmm. One of the figures in the 1830s that I write a lot about is Charles Babbage, who was at the origin of, created the difference engine and then the analytic engine. Difference engine finally only being built in the Science Museum in London in the 1980s, but it was a workable theory and, you know, a precursor to the modern computer, although the analytic engine's a better precursor. Mm-hmm. But Babbage was obsessed by time. You can read this in one of his major and weirder works, which is called The Ninth Bridgewater Treatise of Fragment, which I won't go into, which I might go into a little bit of detail about later. It's also, he was interested in the mode of watch production. Mm-hmm. So watches were one of the first, you know, mass-produced objects in those times, something like 300,000 watches a year being produced in England alone. The Coventry system of watch production was a wonderful system which broke apart a series of very complex tasks, like, you know, watches have many, many moving parts and they're very, very complex, into a series of very simple tasks, the principle of the division of labor. Mm-hmm. As Babbage was looking at the clock factories, that's when he got the idea for building up his difference engine and later the analytic engine, take a complex series of tasks, reduce it to a very simple set of tasks and repetitive sets of additions and subtractions, and then you can do complex operations at speeds and in ways in which humans couldn't do them. So time was highly important metaphorically for Babbage, and at the same time, watch production provided a way of moving directly from the Industrial Revolution and the division of labor within that into the computer.
Hmm, interesting. And then both Lyell and Babbage had a notion that the Earth itself is an archive, didn't they? And Babbage has this interesting statement that even the air itself is a kind of library.
Babbage got, I mean, it's interesting, there was this really stormy relationship between Lyell and Babbage in the 1830s. Let me start with Babbage on the air as a library, and then let's go backwards from that.
Okay.
The air as a library, the way that that works is that he says that every utterance which has ever been made on the history of the Earth creates a set of vibrations. Those vibrations continue eternally, getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, so that if we had a sufficiently good hearing trumpet, which is the language that he used rather than our sensitive devices of today, then we would be able to hear the words of Jesus, you know, and the Sermon on the Mount. Mm-hmm. So that was his theory of the memory. Now remember, this is before the days of the second law of thermodynamics, which says that basically it would damp out and become, you know, completely unattainable after a fairly short period of time. Now, Herschel and Lyell were both very, very opposed to this. John Herschel, the astronomer, and Lyell said, look, basically, Babbage, that's ridiculous. Of course that's not true. And it's a really interesting point. Well, first of all, why did Babbage really hold to that? And secondly, what's at stake in the distinction? Now, why Babbage held to it, you know, I think, was precisely this idea of the dream of the perfect archive, the dream that basically we were moving into an era in which all things would be remembered for all time. And Babbage's discourse rates very highly on that. I mean, his idea is that the good and great of all ages will remember all the, you know, all the great scientists, all the great genius scientists for all time. We will be able to store all information for all time. He's part of, he's very associated with the kind of encyclopedist movement there, which is the idea from, you know, from France in the late 18th century, we can store all of knowledge for all time. So the idea that what we're finding or what we're creating in the society is something that we can recognize in the world around us as being motive in the world around us is central to his thinking. Now that might seem a little, you know, somewhat strange logic, but then you start thinking about other major technologies we've had over the last 100 years alone, say. Take the telephone. Mm-hmm. We create the telephone as a technical device, and then the field of neuropsychology takes it up, and there are a whole series of tracks in the 1920s about the brain as a switchboard. We then get into computers today, and we've got, what's the great theory? Well, it's a theory of neural nets, which again is echoing the technology of our time and, if you like, throwing it out into nature and reading nature in terms of that technology, in terms of the way in which the technology works. And that's unsurprising. We're just taking what we see around us and what we experience and what we're most familiar with, and we're saying, well, hey, is that a good way of seeing the world? Is that a way of understanding the world? We're often unaware of how we're doing it, and particularly if we get trapped in this idea of universal scientific progress, then we think, well, no, these metaphors aren't really important. And I think these metaphors really, really are important, and I think you can find these regularities across time.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's really at the core of your book, I think, isn't it? That the truths that we regard as universal truths are to some extent based on the technologies that we use to come to these truths.
That's exactly it. I mean, there's a wonderful phrase by Harry Becker, the sociologist, which is, if you ask typical scientists, what were they like in the past and what do we know today? And he says, well, the canonical scientific response is, they used to think, now we know. And it's that idea that, it's true that every scientist in the past that we look at has been influenced by the technology of the day, has been influenced by the social and political values, but today somehow it's different
going forward.
And I think all you need to do is take out that last little bit and say, no, we're all part of that game. And it's not a bad thing to be part of that game. And that's the other thing. It's not critical of science. It's not saying science is bad. It's saying, well, let's just explore the fact that we do have those social, cultural, and political values deeply embedded in our scientific and philosophical thinking.
The next era of memory practices you look at are that of the 1960s through about the 1980s, the era of cybernetics, systems analysis, and centralized computing. And this is also the era of high modernism that we remember as being utopian, futuristic, structuralist, ahistorical, I would say, for the most part, and in the West at least, democratic, but also from a postmodern perspective, we recall it as being a time subject to a kind of totalizing rigidness. So can you talk about how the archive comes to be conceived in the era of the cyberneticists?
Sure. Let me start with just evoking the, I think we need it for the story, just evoking the, you know, the sense of excitement.
Yeah, which is lost to us now, strangely, considering how important this was at the time, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. There's the idea that cybernetics was going to be the science of all sciences, that it was going to provide a way that, you know, we could translate quantum mechanics into biology, into engineering, that we could use cybernetics in order to make men machines, that we could rationalize our economies using cybernetics. Indeed, Andrea Allende, Chile's Minister of Finance, was actually a trained cybernetician and consulted with Stafford Bayer, who was one of the originators of the discipline of cybernetics. What happened there was, I mean, it's, the sense of excitement comes in a couple of ways. It's, first of all, you've got Norbert Wiener's Introduction to Cybernetics when that comes out. And Wiener is someone, as you know, many scientists after World War II were going, what the heck did we do? You know, we just dropped a nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
Looks like technology is out of control. Looks like society is out of control. We need to be able to set up proper kind of, you know, what they call feedback loops, control mechanisms. It's, you know, cybernetics is in many ways a discipline about control and about feedback. And unless we can do that, then we risk total destruction. So it was seen as an urgent kind of social necessity that we have a deeper, more systematic understanding of the way in which society works and the way in which changes can be made in order to avoid what was seen then as an imminent, you know, possible imminent catastrophe, the sort of atmosphere that Jeff Nuttall talks about in Bomb Culture, where, you know, it's like, hey, the world's going away tomorrow.
Yeah, I found interesting, you know, what you had to say about the fear specifically among serious thinkers of the time of this kind of myth of the automaton that takes over humankind that we actually still see echoes of. I mean, I was just watching the Sarah Connor Chronicles on Fox earlier this week, and it's precisely still about that. The Terminators and computers taking over the Earth.
Oh, absolutely. There's that as well. I mean, it's a couple of points on that. It's really interesting. I mean, yeah, cybernetics was certainly part of the triumph of automation. It was seen as that. When we had automation in the 1960s, that was often conceived as liberatory for humans.
Yeah.
We would be able to, you know, the question would be, could we build enough golf courses to deal with the extra leisure time we're going to have? Today, that's not how we conceive of automation. I think it's really interesting in that respect.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, the dream's not dead. I mean, it's like cybernetics as a discipline didn't work. But if you look at something like, you know, Ray Kurzweil's singularity talk, that somehow we're moving to a next stage, a tipping point, and at that tipping point, we're going to have a massive increase in our intelligence through being able to embed computers into our lives, into our souls, and into the world around us. So we're going to create this one vast intelligent noosphere, to use Teilhard Chardin's term.
Yeah.
Now, that kind of millennial vision, by the way, is key to understanding one of the main planks of cybernetics. It's the idea that things are about to change in a huge way. And every generation since the 1830s has had a good scientific and technological argument to say that that's going to be happening.
Yeah.
And this was the flavor that it took in the 1960s. And that millennialism is, for me, not all that much different from millennialism that you'll find in various, you know, religious fundamentalist groups. It's just as unfounded, but it's just as interesting a kind of historical phenomenon. You know, it's kind of après nous le déluge, or après nous le changement. But let me kind of backtrack just a second, because I wanted to bring out the other aspect of why I think cybernetics was so exciting, and that's the Macy conferences, which occur in the late 40s, early 50s, which have been beautifully written about by Stephen Heim in his book, The Cybernetics Group. And it's amazing if you look at the set of figures who are actually having interesting cross-disciplinary dialogues with each other. You've got sitting around in the same room, you've got someone like Norbert Wiener, who's a great mathematician on the mathematics of feedback control, but who'd also worked initially on gunnery in World War II, and so very practical as well as a great mathematician. You had McCulloch and Pitt, who were some of the greatest neuroscientists of the time. You had engineers, and then you had Gregory Bateson, you know, one of the great social thinkers of our time, and Margaret Mead, one of the great anthropologists of our time, sitting around in the same room. And what cybernetics seemed to offer was the ability for all of these folks to learn from each other and build off each other's work.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways it worked. I mean, if you take the very, very engineering concept of feedback, that was brought into psychology by Bateson, you know, the school of Palo Alto in the 1960s, so that now when we talk about giving people feedback or positive feedback or negative feedback, that's precisely the taking of an engineering metaphor and bringing it into our understanding of ourselves and our understanding of our relationships with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that double part of excitement. I mean, first you've got the sense of necessity. We need cybernetics, but with cybernetics, we can totally revolutionize all the sciences that we're dealing with. Which then moves on to the question of, well, hey, what is the archive? You know, what's their view of the archive?
Yeah, exactly.
What happens with cybernetics is basically emptying out the archive. We don't need to know about the past at all.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of ways in which that works. Let me describe the ways before I come back to the significance of it. One way is, well, let's assume that the world or whatever we want, you know, whatever entity we're looking at is a closed system, which is how so-called first-order cybernetics or the early cybernetics worked. If it is, then all we need to know is the current state of the machine,
because
everything's a machine, the current state of the machine and the rules. We don't need to know anything about how it got there. That's enough for us to be able to say what's going to happen in the future. So the past becomes effectively irrelevant for them.
Yeah, you mentioned that every scientific discipline displays its own total recall in this scenario.
No, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
So that we don't need to remember specific things about the past. All we need to know is a set of rules.
Yeah.
Which are working. So essentially what you're doing is dealing with a somewhat stateless present into the future, and that's basically all you need. I mean, it's sort of the era, to draw a very general example, you know, we're looking back on natural history and saying, well, natural history is just rubbish.
Yeah.
What we need is to understand the mechanisms that are in play, and that was very much true in molecular biology. It's very much true in all, you know, across the biological sciences. So the cyberneticians were certainly not alone in saying, all we need is the rules and the mechanisms. We do not need the specifics of the past.
Yeah, and these could all be structured into a logic that the computer processor would understand and hold, essentially.
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's right. And that's one of the interesting things about it, that it's precisely because, if you like, that that's the kind of thing that computers can deal with very well and can remember very well. They're great on rules and regulations. Yeah. They're not great on, you know, specifics of the past. Yeah. For precisely the reason that you can't get anything in a computer unless you played with a classification system, which is already a system for forgetting.
Yeah.
So again, it's mirroring the potential of the computer, the potential of the new technology into the practice of the science and the understanding of the science.
The third era of modern scientific memory practice that you write about is that of the present, characterized by the database in the science of biodiversity. And one of the memorializing practices that characterize this era is that we record not just conclusions about data, say in scientific journals, but we record and store the data itself. And we record untold heaps of data in paper form, but also on film and especially electronically in databases. So the question is, what kind of archive are we building in this present memory practice, and how does it differ from or resemble the archives of the past two centuries?
It's a great question. Unfortunately, with an extremely long answer,
yeah.
So I'll try and,
well, that's good, so, yeah.
Try and make it coherent. Let's look at what we're doing. I mean, we're putting sensors in nature right now all around the place. We get terabytes of data which are coming in from observational stations all around the world. We're collecting massive amounts of data about our citizens. Although my favorite example of this was that in the 1970s, British intelligence had basically a 300-page file on every man, woman, and child in Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't stop the IRA from working because they didn't have people to read those 300 pages, every man, woman, and child. So that's one of the really interesting paradoxes of it. So the idea is that memory is cheap. So we can store everything, therefore we should store everything. Now, that's got some really nice features. If you want to publish an article now in one of the journals of the Ecological Society of America, you need to publish your database as well, so that other people can come in and look at your database. Scientific practice is changing sort of slowly about this. The thing that's really holding up scientific practice, as I've tried to deal with in a couple of universities, is that we do not reward the publishing of data or the creating of databases. We reward academic publications which nobody is going to read.
In conventional form.
In conventional form, which nobody is going to read and use. That's exactly right. So it's certainly not happening across the board in the way in which we might hope, but that's the potential, is that you're going to be publishing data, and the publishing a database is going to be as important and as recognized as creative an act as writing a scientific paper, and I think we are moving slowly into that era. However, we also say that memory is cheap, and it's not. The records that we're producing right now, electronic records are incredibly expensive to maintain over the long term. There's a wonderful picture I have, I wish I could show it to you, of one of the main banks in San Francisco, which has basically a warehouse which is full of old computers. So that they can run the necessary programs going back to the 1960s, you know, using that form.
Yeah.
Now, that's hugely problematic because every time that you move onto a different recording mechanism, every time you use onto a different operating system, every time there's a revolutionary and incremental change in the technology, someone needs to do the work of migrating the data from one form to another. And that really, really is not easy. That's expensive. It's generally an unfunded mandate.
Yeah.
So we've got people who are running around who are saying, well, we're remembering everything, we're storing everything, but we're not putting into place the institutions that we need in order for that to happen.
Yeah.
But the advantages, should we do this? Let me talk normatively for a second and then a little bit about differences with the past eras. Should we succeed in doing this, we could do some pretty amazing re-understandings of the past.
Mm-hmm.
There's the example that I gave a little bit earlier about AIDS, you know.
Yeah.
If we develop the archive in the right way, there's another classification system called the Reed classification system, where you do not have to determine a single cause of death, so we wouldn't have to put it down to Kaposi's sarcoma or the pneumonia. What you do is you store the set of symptoms and all the treatments that were received and the outcome in a single number string.
Yeah.
You could then use that number string to reconfigure, to reclassify the old data. And that's one of the things we really need to work on, is how can we create these flexible databases which will enable us to rework the past.
Yeah.
Another possibility, which I think is just marvelous right now, it comes out of a group of ecologists I've been studying called the Long-Term Ecological Research Network, which is it's a network of 30-odd sites across America and one in Antarctica, where they're trying to create long-term baselines of ecological data.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been one of the paradoxes of ecology, that ecology is as a discipline has tended to work at very short time scales and very short spatial areas, precisely because the average scientist's career lasts about 30 years, after which their records tend to get thrown away. And so it's very, very difficult to create those baselines where we're going to be able to store data over a 50, 100-year period, and ecosystems change in 50 or 100-year chunks.
Yeah.
So again, there's a possibility of really reconfiguring the scientific enterprise in such a way that it truly is seen as a collective cumulative enterprise in a new kind of way.
Yeah, that means a massive revision of the way we classify knowledge, doesn't it, in the sciences, so that people in different disciplines, say, can talk to one another.
Oh, that's absolutely right. Yeah. One of the things that the National Science Foundation is really pushing right now is, you know, what they call cyber infrastructure, and that there are all of these over-the-top dreams for the possibilities of cyber infrastructure. But the projects are really interesting that they're funding, many of them, because what they're trying to do is to get folks talking who have not been able to talk before because of disciplinary boundaries. And the role of classification and the role of one of the buzzwords right now within the computer science field for this is ontology. So what are the objects that you see the world as being constituted by? The role of ontology and classification is central in creating this possibility of a really kind of live discourse across many scientific fields. I'll give you a few examples of how that might be working out. One is a project called GEON, which is down in San Diego Supercomputer Center. It brings together about 20 or 30 disciplines which are involved in the geological sciences, from geophysics to seismology to geology, geology pure and simple, or rock and hammer, to environmental hydrology, to atmospheric physics. And it enables them to work together in such a way that they can answer questions they couldn't answer in the past. So what caused such and such an extinction event? If we can pull it down to a 10,000-year period or a 1,000-year period, if it's 1,000 years, it might have been a meteor. If it's 10 or 20,000 years, it might have been climate change.
Yeah.
So you're able to answer questions. You know, in theory, you're able to answer questions that you couldn't even pose before.
Yeah, interesting.
Another example, which I'm just getting involved in now, and I just love this case, is the Museum of Comparative Anthropogeny. Anthropogeny being theories of human origins. And that's a cyber infrastructure project which is bringing together folks from ape physiology, human physiology, anthropology, linguistics, to say, well, what makes humans humans? And so there is a potential great enabling factor within the new cyber infrastructures we're creating. What we have a need for, though, is for information scientists and library scientists, I mean, folks who can think carefully about the decisions that we're making today and the way in which they're really shaping the archive for the future.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful phrase that, again, Derrida uses in Archive Fever about this. He says, look, the archives that we create are sequential. They're sequential in the sense of, you know, the archive starts at this point.
Yeah.
Once we've got most things online, we're never going to go back to books. Nobody ever goes back to card catalogs. I mean, it's basically, if it's there online, that's what's in the archive. So it's just sequential in that sense. But it's also, and this is the key, it's also what he calls jussive. Mm. It's got a normative and it's got a moral force. It's saying, this is allowed into the archive, this is not allowed into the archive. And I think that's one of the great social and political questions of our time, and scientific questions, is what are we excluding from the archive? How do we understand that exclusion?
Mm-hmm.
Not with a view to saying, let's just create a bigger and better mousetrap where we save all information, but saying we need to understand the pattern of exclusions as well as the pattern of inclusions. Otherwise, we're losing the opportunity to really leverage this technology in interesting and new ways.
Yes, librarians like myself often wonder what we're going to do when the device comes along that truly replaces the printed book. But looking at the possibility for projects opening up before us with the powers available even to us now in the universe of collaborative archiving, there seems to be work for armies of people in academe who have theoretical and practical knowledge of informatics to wade forward in close collusion with researchers, philosophers, and scientists into this new world of memorialization.
Oh, absolutely, and I totally think we should. One of my heroes in this field is the old librarian Sandy Berman. I mean, you know, he's been waging this battle against Library of Congress classification
for years.
And in some ways it's over the top, but in other ways, hey, he's quite right. there are certain kinds of ways of understanding black culture that it's very, very difficult to get out of the LC system, Library of Congress system, precisely because it's buried and distributed. So understanding those roles of what's getting buried, what's getting distributed away, why do we understand blacks one way in the Library of Congress, whites another, and Native Americans a third way? You know, why do we have three different sets of categories, which is so disjunct?
Yeah.
Well, that's classification systems are Crete. What we need to do is really be thinking significantly about information, and this isn't just about cutting-edge scientific disciplines.
No.
What I tell my students right now coming in is that, hey, you know, right, you've got your laptop there now. What you're creating there on your laptop, the way in which you're storing your files and folders, the way in which you're arranging your information, that's going to have a legacy which is going to be there for, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years. I mean, I'm still using basically the same files and folders that I created in Illinois in 1992, mm-hmm. I think. These things really persist, and they really make a difference.
Yeah.
So to the extent that which we can train our students and train ourselves to think really, really intelligently about the ways in which we're storing information, and the fact that adopting a particular storage system or archival mechanism has very, very direct consequences on the kinds of knowledge you're going to be able to produce at the other end.
Yeah.
That's a skill that we need for this age, just as in the 19th century, you'd be crazy if you didn't know how to read a book and if you hadn't learned how to read books. But we do not have lessons enough, anywhere near enough lessons, for everybody in how to read databases and how to understand databases.
And with respect to older kinds of databases, you had an interesting passage on the way fossil evidence is classified, where there really isn't a good system, evidently, and people who need to read fossil evidence, they sort of make it up as they go along. I know there is a science that deals with classification of fossils, but it doesn't really work for, say, people who are trying to use fossil evidence to find petroleum, say.
That's exactly the issue. I mean, that's one of timing. It's that the quote-unquote scientific process actually works relatively slowly. To get a finding about a fossil into print, then it needs to, you know, wend its way through the peer review process, which certainly in my field can take a couple of years for an article coming out. Now, if I'm on a new oil field, then I need to know right now. So I'll just produce a random classification system, which will be very difficult to translate into the scientific terms. There's a really interesting thing about fossils there that you know, in the old days, we still have the remains of it. We used to have a kind of hierarchical databases were built, and a hierarchical database being that, okay, well, first of all, we have flora and fauna, then we have the kingdoms, then we have the genesis, then we have the species, you know, and then we have the subspecies kind of going down, 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 down. And if you want to do a search through a hierarchical database, then what you'd do is you'd start at the top and just follow the path down to where you wanted to go in the end.
Which is how all the library classification systems work, whether it's Dewey or LC or what have you.
That's right. Yeah. Now, the downside of that is that every time you got a new fossil species that came in and changed the hierarchy one way or another by showing that there was the two things were related but we thought weren't related or that there was another step in the hierarchy, then in principle you had to change all your databases.
The whole system, yes.
Which was, you know, basically impossible. And so one of the moves that was made there was just to exclude new fossil evidence from the botanical databases that were being built. So, you know, you've got this really strange thing where it's, I mean, that's kind of the cart driving the horse, where because we have databases of such and such a form, we just can't account for this new evidence.
Yeah.
You use an interesting term, the mnemonic deep, and I wonder if you could just talk about it briefly, because I was fascinated by the term and what you meant by it and the way you would like to see it operating in this new future of remembering.
Sure. The phrase itself comes from Thomas Pynchon, and you know, I think Thomas Pynchon's one of the great comic writers of our time, but this is from the book Mason and Dixon, and it actually comes from someone that he's quoting within the book, Mason and Dixon being actually about, it's very much a novel about time and space in the period that I'm talking about. Mason Dixon of the Mason Dixon line and their early years in mapping longitude and then their later years, including one of the funniest passages I've ever read, which is about, you know, this somewhat apocryphal story that when we moved from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar in the 1760s, that there were riots in London because people were claiming that we've lost 11 days. What they did was they adjusted the calendar and jumped it 11 days forward so that we were in line with the rest of Europe. And it was the idea, well, the Catholics have stolen our 11 days, and so there were riots in the streets of London. And then he has this lovely passage, which is imagining what happened during those stolen 11 days. But anyway, the mnemonic deep, what he's referring to there, and it's central to the picture of my book, is that if we start telling our stories, fitting into a single universal history, a single universal classification system, or in the more up-to-date languages today, a single semantic web. Mm-hmm. If we try and do something like that, if we try and conjure our data into that single form, then we can tell one story.
Yeah.
But that one story is a little bit like Library at Alexandria. I mean, that one story gets blown up. We've got no idea.
Yeah.
What I'm interested in, and I think what we need to be working towards, is actually this idea of the reconfigurable past, so that we've got an archive that is not, as much as possible, I mean, there's no perfect solution, as much as possible, not particularly tied to our current theories, but can change flexibly over time. The significance of that, as far as the mnemonic deep is concerned, and let me describe that phrase. Mnemonic deep is basically his image of what the past is really like.
Mm-hmm.
That there are many, many capillaries that lead into any story that you're telling. There are many, many ways of understanding the past. What we need to do is keep open those multiple braids, because we're going to want to rebraid later. We're going to want to tell other stories later. So it's a kind of call to say, hey, that mnemonic deep, that area that we can't get into, that past which is so deeply lost, if we just have a single line back into it, we're going to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
If we can deliberately create multiple lines back into it, and we can do through intelligent, you know, use of information systems, through intelligent thinking about information systems, then we can create a much richer past, an open past, as I call it, rather than this kind of closed past that you create if you overclassify too early, if you're too restrictive in your archive.
Yeah. So do we have to create a kind of information ethics, do you think, where maybe humility is an important virtue, apart from being able to talk to one another?
Oh, I'd absolutely love that. I mean, one of the areas that I'm moving into right now is representations of indigenous knowledge. That in itself is such a horrible phrase, because it suggests, well, this indigenous knowledge, then there's our knowledge, which isn't indigenous.
Yeah, indigenous folks don't always like it.
Exactly. Or if you're mestizo, you say, well, what the heck are you calling an indigenous for?
Yeah. Interesting. We're going to be talking with K. David Harrison in the next few weeks about his book that he just published, When Languages Die, which warns that as languages are lost, so does access to the knowledge that they contain, which is, so to speak, archives, since languages are knowledge systems and essentially archives also.
Oh, I'll definitely tune into that. I'll be very interested. I mean, there's some very, very interesting politics around, quote-unquote, preserving linguistic diversity.
Yeah.
Because part of the problem is, like, if I'm out there in the middle of the rainforest somewhere and I have a chance of hooking into the benefits that there are of Western civilization, then I think it's much more logical for me to be speaking English or speaking French or Chinese or one of the languages with a great user group, even though I can see the value in preserving linguistic diversity. It's like, yeah, but are you creating reservations when you do that?
Yeah.
You know, kind of where you're separating these people off from contact. So I think it's a really interesting point. But yeah, absolutely, humility is key. If you look at the kind of agonistic field of the sciences over the last couple of hundred years, you've tended to have at least one, generally physics, now it's somewhat biology, which says, hey, you know, we've got the key to the world. And I think, you know, what this is showing us, you know, kind of, and one of the great potentials around the archive is, hey, we can all talk to each other, we can move this together, but only if we're really willing to listen, not if we see the others as the empty vessels in which we're going to pour knowledge. So,
last question. Your book itself is a history, and thus a kind of archive and memory practice in itself, and I wonder if your musings on the idea of the archive have affected at all your view of social history and the way you conduct your own research.
Yeah, it's a very difficult question. I mean, certainly yes. You will notice, you know, as I write history, and this has always been true of the historical work that I do, that there's no simple linear narrative there. You know, I don't start on January 1st, 1830, and end on December 31st, 1840. You know, I tend to move in and out of time periods, and I do that deliberately as a kind of unsettling mechanism, if you like. So certainly, stylistically, I think it's had a difference. With respect to my views of social history, yes, definitely. I mean, let me recall, I mean, there's no reason why you should know this, but there's a wonderful debate between Tawney and Trevor Roper in the 1950s. 50s, 60s, which is about the nature of the English Revolution. Tony was a socialist slash Marxist who said basically the English Revolution, 1640 to 1660, was about the rise of the new middle class, you know, so it kind of fits straight into the kind of stage theory that Marx gave us. Trevor Roper said exactly the opposite. He was very conservative in his personal life and his personal beliefs, and he said, no, it was the declining gentry who are trying to keep hold of their values. And this was the talk of cocktail parties all over England, you know, in the time. It was the banner debate within the field of history. Now, the point about that is, suppose there had been a socialist revolution, you know, when Wilson came into power in 1964 in England, you know, and he'd really succeeded in all the nationalization that he was trying to do. In a sense, that socialist revolution would have made Tawney's version of the past true.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what happened was, in the 1980s, we get Margaret Thatcher, which in many ways has, for the present, made Trevor Roper's story much more likely.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to say there is, from my own understanding of this, that our reading and our understanding of the past is affected by what goes on in the present, so that the old history is just, in a sense, never go away. It's like there's that wonderful book by François Furet, Rethinking the French Revolution, which is saying, well, okay, we can consider the French Revolution on certain dates. We can say it's 1789 through 1804, or through 1830, the Glorious July Revolution of 1830, or through 1848, the riots that occur in 1848 right across Europe, or 1789 through 1870, which is the time of the Paris Commune, or 1789 through 1968. And each of those different time periods that you put on the French Revolution gives you a very different understanding of it. So as my understanding of social history is certainly that the past is much more open and reconfigurable than we think.
Interesting. So I'd like to thank you, Jeffrey, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, Memory Practices in the Sciences.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks much, Tom.
We've been talking with Jeffrey C. Bowker, Regis and Diane McKenna Professor at Santa Clara University and Executive Director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Society at Santa Clara, about his book, Memory Practices in the Sciences, published by MIT. And if you tuned in late, you can access a podcast of this and previous broadcasts on the Library Cafe at our website at library-cafe.org, as well as a listing of future interviews. Tune in next week when we'll be talking with Joel Smith, curator of photography at the Princeton University Art Museum, who will be talking about his exhibition entitled Saul Steinberg Illuminations, now on view at the Francis Lehman Loeb Center here at Vassar College through February 24th. You're listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie.
Are you or a family member suffering from a disease? Are you just looking for the latest medical information? Then check out Medline Plus. With information from the National Institutes of Health, the federal government's premier agency supporting medical research, Medline Plus is your one-stop source for the latest medical information. Information about prescription drugs, clinical trials, and all sorts of information pertaining to your health. There's even a medical encyclopedia. It's all right there on your computer, www.medlineplus.gov. And if you crave the latest news from the cutting edge of medical science, PubMed Central and the NIH's new public access program can lead you there. The NIH Public Access Archive program is adding to the nearly 500,000 research articles already available online in PubMed Central. Log on to the NIH homepage, www.nih.gov, and click the link for public access. That's Medline Plus for up-to-date medical info and public access and PubMed Central for the latest medical research results. These services brought to you by the National Institute of Health.